I switched the gospel this morning, so that's why we had a little, yes, right. That's one of the privileges of being the pastor. You can change your mind at the last minute. You can fight God all you want to on that score, but the reading from Romans 5, 12 through 21 is like peeling an onion. There's layer upon layer upon layer, and the longer we sit with it, the harder it seems to be. It's not that Paul is trying to make things difficult, it's just that Paul is difficult. He is a philosopher and a theologian. He's steeped in the intricacies of the Greco-Roman theoretical practices. He's a logician. He lays out his thesis and then makes his case point by point. He's considered a genius in this by anyone who studies rhetoric. So why would such a thick, dense passage be offered as a lectionary reading? It's hard to grasp in one reading, one hearing, isn't it? To follow that train of thinking. Well, it is because it's worth the work. But the beauty of Paul's work is that even the most cursory reading can yield up a sense of what he's saying. For instance, we can pick out certain key words: sin, death, trespass, disobedience, condemnation. That's a pretty consistent theme right there. He's going somewhere. We also have the words grace, free gift, life, provision of grace, righteousness, justification, acquittal. Okay, another train of thought. And we have a pretty good idea what these words mean. They're pretty clear. So let's put them together. In this corner of the mat, we have sin, death, trespass, disobedience, and condemnation. Those are the words associated with Adam and Adam's sin, the consequence of Adam's sin. The eating of the tree of good and knowledge, trying to be like God. It wasn't about the fruit. It was about the egotism of wanting to be like God. That great sin led to death and disobedience and condemnation. In the other corner of the mat, we have grace, free gift, life, provision of grace, righteousness, and justification. Paul tells us that God has addressed the problem of Adam and unleashed by his disobedience, his sin, and God has addressed the problem through Christ and Christ's obedience. Because of God's free love, God answers sin with grace. And this grace is free. The death precipitated by sin is conquered, and the life, capital L, now reigns. The disobedience of Adam is overcome by the righteousness of Christ. Christ's righteousness, evidenced by Christ's obedience, even to the cross, answers the condemnation with justification and acquittal. Christ is the victor, the Redeemer. Paul tells us that Adam's condemnation for all, Jew and Gentile alike, Christ brings justification for all, Jew and Gentile alike. No one is left out of that circle. The reign of death is ended, the reign of life inaugurated, and the hinge pin of it all is the cross. Thomas Wright puts it this way: the cross, where the kingdom of sin did its worst, where the kingdom of grace did its triumphant best. This that Paul unfolds for us is what we might call the end game. This is the outcome of Jesus' life, his teaching, his works, his challenges, his death, his resurrection. But why was it that the leaders of his day were so outraged by him that they put him to death? I have been asked, why did Jesus have to die? Why blood? Well, I'm going to venture into that this Lenten season and try to answer those questions or offer some sort of answer for you. So that will be our focus over the next few weeks. We begin today with a little history. Now, I'm going to ask you to keep the Paul thing kind of like a basket holding everything else. It's going to wrap it all up in the end, but I wanted to give you the end before we get into the process that we got to get to the end, so that you would know where we're going to come out in the end. We're going to come out with hope, with life, with wonder. But to get there, it's a little rocky and a little narrow. We begin first by understanding, because I think it is important to understand the mentality, the psychology, if you will, the worldview, rather, of the original people who witnessed Jesus and what he did and listened to him in what he said. And the first thing we're going to talk about today is the fact that their identity as a people, the people of Israel, had an identity that was intricately linked with land, with territory. Land had been a promise to Abraham when God marked out the boundaries for him, that the land that his descendants would occupy in due time. Sovereignty over that land was central to their identity, and they longed for a reign like King David. When they were an independent country and thriving under that kingship. But as time went on, bad king came to the throne, the people wandered away, they became idolatrous, and judgment came upon them in the form of the Babylonian exile. They're carted off to another land, taken out of their land. And there they languish for several years. The Babylonian exile is the answer to their apostasy, an act of judgment, you might say, the consequence of their waywardness. And while in exile, they came to realize just how deeply they had wronged God, and they were repentant. So they are returned to the land. And most of us of modern Christianity think that's the end of the exile. They came back to the land, right? But they didn't see it that way. For though they came back to the land and started to rebuild, they did not regain sovereignty. When Jesus comes, they are still waiting for the end of exile. They are still waiting for sovereignty to be restored to them, for say over their own territory, to be a people independent of everyone else. This restoration of sovereignty in their mind represented God's full forgiveness. We cannot understand how deeply embedded in their psyche this ownership and this rulership of land was to these people, but we need to understand that to understand what Jesus did and how they heard him. These people hung on the promises declared by Isaiah. The restoration of the land of milk and honey, and there's a beautiful passage in Isaiah 35 and another one in 61 where there is depicted for the people this restoration of the land where trees will grow and they'll harvest from their own fields. The milk and honey will flow. The riches from other nations will come to them. And they're thinking, yes, yes, finally, that's what we're going to experience. And they keep waiting for it, and it doesn't come, it doesn't come, and it doesn't come. When Jesus stands up that morning to read from the scroll of Isaiah, he doesn't read the part in those passages about the land. Rather, he reads the part about the restoration of the people. The blind will see, the deaf will hear. When Jesus goes out into the streets and countryside, he doesn't recruit an army, as some of his day were doing. He heals the sick. He even goes so far as to heal foreigners. He goes to Gennesaret and takes care of the man possessed of the demons, to Samaria and sits at a well and engages a woman in conversation. He heals the daughter of a Syrophoenician woman and a servant of a centurion. What on earth is he doing? He doesn't talk about the land. He doesn't talk about sovereignty. He talks about the people. He talks about blessing. He talks about restoring them to health. For in those Isaiah passages, not only is the land to be restored to them and their sovereignty over it, but the people are to be made well too. And that is where Jesus puts his focus. This did not sit well. In fact, in Luke 14, Jesus even goes so far as to suggest that people give up the land altogether when he tells them to sell all their possessions. There's one possession that's premier over any other, and that's land. The story of the prodigal son, if you will remember, one of the big central issues with the prodigal was that he sold the land his father passed to him. It was an abomination. You didn't sell your land. You could lose it, but you didn't sell it. We don't really have an equivalent in our day, unless Jesus would show up and tell us we have to give up all sports. I know, it's kind of humorous, but we all know that football is the new American religion, don't we? Jesus is trying to demonstrate to the people of his day that the identity of the faithful is not measured by land or any external symbol or standard, save the right alignment with God, wherein compassion and justice are the hallmarks, not just to one's own, but to all. And seeing the good of the other, the distinguishing characteristic of their lives. Hesed, be a blessing, going back to Abraham again, before he was ever promised land. He was told to be a blessing, and that through him all the world would be blessed. And that's the legacy we're asked to carry forward. That was the legacy they were supposed to carry forward, and they failed to do it. And they're still having a hard time, even though they've given up the idols, they're having a hard time understanding what they're supposed to be about, where their true identity is, and Jesus is trying to help them see that. This puts the question to us, as a people today, to what degree is our greater life marked by compassion and justice? And as people of faith, how consistent and obvious are our acts of blessing? What might get our ire up if Jesus came to our town and spoke to us, I wonder? So land was one of the assaults Jesus did. He didn't get an army, but he did push against the conventions of the day, the wrongful thinking of the people. And he does that for us today if we have ears to hear and the will to follow. So next week, we'll talk about another symbol he challenged and how that felt. And we will do this for the next four Sundays. And then on the fifth Sunday, we will talk about the cross and why Jesus had to die. And I'll also touch upon why blood is such a central idea in all of that, so counter to our sensibilities today. But I think it's important for us to try to step back into another century and try to understand it so that we can appropriate and own and understand what God has done for us. So I hope you'll go on the walk with me. But let's not forget what Paul says, that through Jesus, all was and is made well. And so we can sing, "It is well with my soul," can't we? So I invite you to stand.